Chapter 23. At Any Expense. There are regulations to manage the drilling of oil so that we can reap the benefits of the resource while also preserving the land from which we extract it. Other regulations keep car and machine emissions in check to ensure that we can have our conveniences and still maintain air quality. This is what good regulations do. They attempt to balance the benefit and the cost of that benefit. It is an inexact science, but few would disagree that imbalance, one way or the other, would be damaging to commerce or our lives. And so the process of trying to maintain the balance continues in earnest. In the early 20th century, the electromagnetic spectrum was viewed as a publicly owned natural resource, and a scarce one at that. With the arrival of radio, the broadcast industry was a bit like the Wild West, with too many broadcasters attempting to be heard on a limited number of wavelengths. And so Congress passed the Radio Act of 1927 to help organize the system. The act was later replaced by the Communications Act of 1934, which also introduced the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, as part of Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal. The new act and the new commission also took responsibility for the new medium of television and, as with radio, did the work of helping the broadcast industry grow while also protecting the public's access to information. One of the ways in which the FCC could regulate the limited resource was to require broadcasters to have a license to broadcast on the public spectrum. One of the requirements to obtain a broadcast license was for the networks to provide public service programming for the community from whose airwaves it was profiting. The networks feared they would lose their licenses to operate if they did not comply, and thus was born the evening news. Programming meant to serve the public interest apart from the commercial interest of the rest of the network programming. Though the networks didn't make a lot of money from the news, they did gain something just as important to their businesses, something that money couldn't buy, a reputation for integrity. Walter Cronkite, who served as anchorman of the CBS Evening News from 1962 to 1981, was considered the most trusted man in America, a reputation that clearly benefited the entire CBS organization. Both Cronkite and the other newsmen of the day thought of themselves as having a mission. We were sort of driven during the 1960s by this quasi-religious drive to give people the information they needed to have, says Ted Koppel, the award-winning newsman and former host of Nightline. The news fulfilled an obligation to the public. It was ostensibly the lost leader that permitted NBC, CBS, and ABC to justify the enormous profits made by their entertainment divisions, Koppel explains. It never occurred to the network brass that news programming could be profitable. The system of give and take was balanced. But near the end of 1979, something happened. On November 4th, a group of Islamist students and militants stormed the American embassy in Tehran and took captive 52 Americans. Not long after, ABC News debuted America Held Hostage, the Iran Crisis, a series developed expressly to cover developments in the hostage crisis. Later renamed Nightline, the show Ted Koppel anchored for 25 years, gave Americans an update on the crisis every night of the 444-day ordeal. The program was instantly popular, and for the first time in news history, the network executives took notice. Instead of leaving the news alone to be run by cause-driven, idealistic journalists, they began to see the news as a profit center, and so they started to get more involved. Though programs like 60 Minutes, which had already been on the air for more than a decade, were profitable, they didn't air every night. They weren't the nightly news. What's more, this was a different time. It was now the 1980s. America's wealth and affluence were at an all-time high, and our desire for more wealth and affluence became a force that would drive nearly every facet of life in the country for the decade and beyond, including in broadcast television. Our craving for dopamine was on the rise. The balance was about to tip. With the end of the Iran hostage crisis came the Reagan administration. And with it, a new broadcast sheriff moved into town, newly appointed FCC chairman Mark Fowler. Fowler and many of his supporters saw broadcast television, including television news, as just another business trying to make a buck, With the advent of cable television and the introduction of CNN, the news began to transform from a public service and the jewel in the crown of the networks into a 24-hour opportunity to get more jewels. Any obstacle that stood in the way of the networks achieving another hit had to be eliminated. The job of the regulator was no longer to provide protection, but to help drive profit. One by one, sometimes with the support of Congress and sometimes acting alone, Fowler and the FCC slowly dismantled all the standards to which networks needed to adhere to qualify for a broadcast license, standards that aimed to maintain at least some sense of balance by serving the public good. For starters, the time that networks had to renew their licenses was extended from 3 to 5 years, meaning the old fear of losing a license became less of a concern. The number of stations a single company could own went from 7 to 12, giving each holding company a greater opportunity to try to seize more market share. Any provisions for how much advertising could be carried were also eliminated. Fowler's FCC even went so far as to abolish the guidelines that set the minimum amount of non-entertainment programming a network was required to air as a condition of its ability to profit from the public airwaves. The very purpose of the 1934 Act, to reel in the Wild West of the industry and ensure that each network would also offer a public service, was now destroyed. And it didn't stop there. Perhaps the greatest casualty in the network and TV news business came in 1987 with the elimination of the Fairness Doctrine. The Fairness Doctrine was introduced in 1949 to prevent a broadcaster from using a network to advocate one perspective. The doctrine provided that any broadcaster granted a license by the FCC would, as a condition of its license, agree not only to discuss controversial topics that would be in the interest of the public, but also to ensure that any views expressed would be balanced by opposing voices. With that provision having been eliminated, our modern networks now have the right to take a partisan perspective and be as polarizing as they like, whatever is good for business. What the Committee for the Fair Broadcasting of Controversial Issues in 1973 called indispensable and the single most important requirement of operation in the public interest had been disposed of. The path was now completely cleared for news as a service to be replaced by news as another platform on which to sell advertising. As the pursuit of greater abundance continued throughout the 1980s, the destruction of the industry's trust-building elements seemed unstoppable, and the dopamine flowed. No one disputes the right of a company's leaders to grow their businesses in any way they choose, as long as the means they choose are not harmful to the people they claim to serve. The problem is the news business seems to have forgotten the people it is supposed to serve. If we consider the current state of television news, we get a perfect view of what happens when the drive to be first, or boost ratings, is put ahead of the drive to serve the public interest. Among the worst symptoms is the media's willingness to woefully underreport important stories, while it overindulges in the kinds of stories that it might entertain, but hardly inform. Now more than ever, the mission of delivering information has become the business of delivering news. What has happened is not because of journalists. In fact, a good many of them are still driven by the quasi-religious commitment to reporting the truth that Koppel described. The problem lies with the media executives who see the dissemination of information as part of their business portfolios and not as something driven by mission. These executives quickly defend their products as fulfilling their obligation to provide a public service, but their claims are untenable. It is a clear conflict of interest if they count the Nielsen ratings and set advertising rates accordingly. Like a doctor who prescribes the drugs their patients ask for, and not just the ones they need, Koppel says that news organizations went from delivering the news you need, even if you don't want it, to the news you want, even if you don't need it. He laments the bygone days when being a part of a news organization meant something, when it was more of a noble pursuit than a commercial pursuit, a time when newsrooms made the news interesting instead of what they do today, make interesting news. Whether it is a congressman courting donors instead of spending more time responding to the needs of constituents, or a leader of a company who opts to sell products they know might have harmful ingredients because it is profitable, the race to win has always existed and has always caused problems. In healthy organizations, as in healthy society, the drive to win should not precede the desire to take care of the very people we claim to serve. More, more, more. Before the stock market crashed in 1929, there were 25,000 banks in America. However, so many of them were built on such unstable foundations that roughly half of them went out of business in the years immediately following the crash. In 1933, Congress passed the Glass-Steagall Act, then known as the Banking Act of 1933, in an attempt to curb the excessive risk-taking and the speculation of the banking industry so future generations would not find themselves in the same predicament. In addition to the introduction of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, an independent body that preserves and promotes public confidence in the U.S. financial system, other provisions were instituted to reduce the risk the public and the country would have to bear as the banks looked to advance their own interests. One of the most significant provisions of the Act separated commercial banking from investment banking. Commercial banks exist to offer what would be considered traditional banking services, receiving deposits, cashing checks, offering loans, and so on. Investment banks, in contrast, are able to issue securities to help a client raise capital, as well as offer other services, including the trading of equities, commodities, and other financial instruments. Seeing that commercial banks were depositories for personal and business funds, Congress at the time decided that those funds should be off-limits to any investment bank to use for their own speculative and risk-taking ventures. Unfortunately, the future generations our predecessors were trying to protect were less reluctant to risk the public interest to pave the way for new revenue streams. And so, in 1999, at the height of the dot-com boom, during a time of wild speculation, the majority of the Glass-Steagall Act was repealed. The repeal of the Act was justified, as then-Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers said, to, quote, enable American companies to compete in the new economy, unquote. This is political rhetoric to disguise the true intention, to remove regulations specifically designed to protect the public welfare in order to largely help one industry, banking, get bigger so that one group, bankers, could get more hits of dopamine. If competing in the new economy means creating conditions for stock market crashes, then the politicians and the banking lobbies did a great job. With the Act in place, very few large banks failed between 1933 and 1999. And there have only been three significant stock market crashes in the United States since the crash that caused the Great Depression in 1929. Again, there was one crash in 1973, which is the result of a sudden rise in the oil prices and not a banking crisis. Another in 2000 was due to careless betting on the dot-com bubble. The third crash in 2008 resulted from the excessive speculation and risk-taking on the part of the banking industry, as well as the use of mortgage-backed securities. The conditions for the 2008 crash were fueled by companies like Citigroup, previously a commercial bank, and the American International Group, AIG, an insurance company dealing in securities, a practice that would have been forbidden if the Banking Act of 1933 had not been eviscerated less than a decade before. The repeal of most of Glass-Steagall is one of the most obvious and extreme examples of the attempts of some of the me-first boomers to bend or break the laws in the name of self-gain. It's an example of what happens when our leaders put their interests ahead of those they're supposed to protect. On a side note, the events during the period of destructive abundance all happened under the watchful eye of America's first baby boomer president, Bill Clinton, born August 19th, 1946. Addiction has a terrible way of making us lose sight of reality. Like an addict who wakes up regretting what they did under the influence the night before, there are many of the boomer generation who now look back at the destruction accidentally wrought under their watch. And for some of those in charge at the time, the destruction seems to have had a humbling effect. In an interview with Bloomberg Television in 2010, David Kamansky, the former CEO of Merrill Lynch, who Stanley O'Neill replaced, said that it was a mistake to repeal Glass-Steagall. Unfortunately, I was one of the people who led the charge to get Glass-Steagall repealed, he said. Of course, when I was running a firm, I didn't want them to strictly enforce the rules. Kamansky now concedes, I regret those activities and wish we hadn't done that. John Reed, the former co-CEO of Citigroup Incorporated, also said that it was a bad idea to repeal Glass-Steagall. What is it about former CEOs that they are suddenly able to have a kind of sober clarity we wished they had when they were in charge? I understand that we all have 20/20 hindsight, but don't we pay these leaders for their vision and foresight? Beginning in earnest in the 1980s and 1990s, some members of the boomer generation oversaw the steady dismantling of the very controls that were designed to protect us from excess, imbalance, and addiction in our system. The leaders of companies and leaders in government created a strong inner circle with little regard for the protections that are supposed to be offered to others. Just as leaders of any organization are supposed to look after those in their care, which ultimately makes their organization stronger, leaders of companies are also supposed to consider the care of the environment in which they operate. This includes the economy writ large and even civilized society. The circle of safety built to make as many Americans as possible feel safe is now slowly breaking apart, leaving us exposed to greater danger. It weakens a country just as it weakens a company when we have to focus on protecting ourselves from ourselves instead of working together to protect and advance the country as a whole. And if we think the next generation is equipped to fix the problems of the generation before them, we must remind ourselves that they are dealing with addictions of their own.